everyone. Welcome to the 347th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a show full of big old numbers for you today. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to talk about a report out from McKinsey on growth in the IoT. We'll also be talking about Qualcomm's plans for growth, which include the IoT. We've got a snag on the ARM NVIDIA deal. Is that going to happen? Who knows? Apple has some cool patents, and they did lose their HomeKit chief. Boo. Amazon has announced new functionality on your Echo devices and coming into the light switch market with some cheap Amazon Basic gear. We've also got some look-alike gear from Yeelight that we'll talk about. Y'all are going to love it. And Kevin has tried out a brand new app that, my gosh, if you're a HomeKit user, you're going to want to hear about it.
Well, it's new for me, but it's actually in version 5.
Right. It's new to us, but maybe you're already using it. Feel free to tell us about it. And we're also going to hear from our sponsor, Twilio. And our guest this week is Jen Kaltritter, who is the lead on Mozilla's Privacy Not Included project, which came out this week. This is Mozilla's annual list of gadgets and devices that abuse your privacy. So we'll talk about which devices made the grade and which are just plain old creepy. But first, let's hear from another one of our sponsors, Juniper. This week's show is brought to you by Juniper Networks. Sprawling IoT devices are prime targets for attackers. And once infected, they can quickly bring your network down and leave you vulnerable. That's why Juniper has teamed up with Woot Cloud to bring complete visibility and context-aware control for devices the moment they join your network. We've actually written a lot about this tactic in the newsletter. So check out ai.mist.com/StaceyOnIoT to hear from experts at Juniper and Woot Cloud. They're going to share tips and tricks for identifying and securing IoT networks. Plus, you can watch a demo to claim a free Juniper Mist Wi-Fi access point, the only access point in the industry with a port dedicated to IoT. That's ai.mist.com/StaceyOnIoT. And you can get your AP today. Okay, Kevin. Man, it's like 2015 up in here. 2015 was actually the year that McKinsey, big global consulting firm, released a report that got everyone excited about the IoT. In 2015, they put out a report that said the IoT was going to be worth $11 trillion in 2025, which everybody's ears were like, whoa, that's a lot of money. So fast forward, here we are. We're not at 2025 yet. We're at 2021. I'm like, I don't even know.
It's been a long year. It's been a long year.
I wouldn't say we've achieved the $11 trillion in value in the IoT just yet, but that doesn't matter. McKinsey's back with a new report.
I'd say this is revised.
Yes, this is their revised report. And they're saying now by 2030, they estimate the IoT could enable $5.5 trillion to $12.6 trillion in value globally. So, I mean,
yeah. It's hard to estimate these kind of things so far out and not understanding what challenges may lie towards adoption and so on, and what challenges will disappear. And that's what I think they did a pretty good job with. And of course, the pandemic has affected things as well.
Although I will say the pandemic has actually, in most cases, accelerated adoption of IoT across industrial and enterprise clients. So I feel like blaming the pandemic feels kind of like, no.
So that's a good point.
Sorry.
No, you're right. You're right. I mean, if you can find ways to automatically or through algorithms manage your industrial supply chains and production lines and so on without having somebody there because they can't be there because of COVID or something. I mean, sure, that's going to be a benefit.
Yes. And they do some estimates. They estimate that the total value so far captured by 2020 was only $1.6 trillion. And that was pretty low compared to what they were thinking back at 2015. They did start their research before the spread of COVID, but they do acknowledge that COVID has had a pretty significant impact. They just can't calculate it all. they also think that, you know, we're still growing here. And a lot of that's going to come from business, not consumer, which, again, makes total sense. Business is where the big spending is. And factory operations are going to be a significant portion, followed by work sites, so like construction, mining, those kind of things. And then human health, so in medical, that's the big, that's like almost 60-something percent of the value that they're going to see. So some big IoT numbers, little level setting maybe, and most of it's going to come from optimizations of your operations, followed then by human productivity and boosting health. So those are the big things that we're going to see in terms of use cases. We're also going to see a little bit on condition-based maintenance. They assume 12% of the economic value in 2030 will come from that, as opposed to a full 41% from operations optimization. And condition-based maintenance is predictive maintenance, which is one of like, I mean, we hear so much about it, but it's not going to generate as much value as just getting rid of some of the excesses in optimization. So
I see that they have an estimate of 37% cumulative annual growth rate over the next decade for autonomous vehicles. It's actually the highest growth rate.
We're coming from nothing, though, you know?
Yeah, no, and that helps. Small numbers, starting from small numbers definitely helps with that. I guess I'm not questioning their number, but it made me question my own thoughts on where I thought we'd be at this point, say 2 years ago, and we're not where I thought we'd be. It seems to be more challenging than I had perceived and as it was presented a couple of years back, because the change, the adoption is kind of slow. I mean, I'm shopping around for a new car right now just because we're coming off a lease, and I see tons of great, pretty much standard sensor features for safety and some for, I'll say, smart driving, such as automatic lane changes and things like that, smart cruise controls. But I keep reading lately about, you know, new betas for Tesla's autonomous driving and more questions and answers with that and rolling back betas of it. And I know they're not the only one in this space, but they're the, I would say they're the leader. And it's like, are we making the progress that we thought we would? I don't think so.
No, I really thought like, I mean, we had said way back in like 2010 that we would have autonomous cars like by 2025, 2020, you know, fully autonomous cars by 2025. And here we are in 2021. And like, I'm like, yeah, that's not happening.
I'm okay with it. I like to drive personally, but I do like to take advantage of like the smart cruise controls with adaptive and keeping me in my lane. So I just have to leave my hand on the steering wheel. I feel much more like a passenger when I want to, but I actually do like driving. So that's just me.
Yes. And the report is full of things that, hey, here's what it takes to scale the IoT. Designing from scale. Don't just do a pilot. You have got to like really deploy all at once. It's like a sea change. You got to just let it wash over people.
Go big or go home.
Yeah. You also have to take it, again, away from just the IT. This is your entire organization needs to change. We need to push for interoperability. There's a lot more. I'll try to get some of these guys to talk to us maybe on the show next week about what's happening, or maybe the week after, for their advice. Because, you know, otherwise you pay a lot for McKinsey. All right, let's talk about other big numbers. Qualcomm. Qualcomm did their investor and analyst day this week, and, you know, it was a big freaking deal. I'm just going to go with that. And one of their big numbers is they think that the IoT is going to reach $9 billion for them by 2024, which, wow, go them. That feels like a lot. Their CEO, Cristiano Amon, said that they're actually going to have to kind of hold back a little on IoT development because this chip slowdown means that they're allocating their production towards kind of higher profit margin chips, higher value chips. So those for smartphones, servers, that sort of thing. So IoT is going to grow a little bit slower, but holy cow, $9 billion by 2024 is nothing to scoff at.
Yeah, that would be their second largest profit, or I should say revenue generation, because mobile is obviously, and by mobile I mean chips and smartphones and tablets and likely computers over the next coming years running on ARM chips. I mean, that generates the bulk of their royalties and so on. But they also have an RF line, automotive line, and IoT. And out of those three, IoT was the bigger or the biggest of the three. So
yeah, sales in IoT for this year, they were up 66% to $1.54 billion last quarter. The same period, the flagship phone business was $4.69 billion. So, you know, they got a ways to go, but it's still significant. So
a nice chunk of change.
And one of the big things Qualcomm's betting on is a distributed edge. And we talk about this a lot, but the idea here is that we're going to need computers and everything, and we're going to figure out ways to orchestrate, you know, data movement and applications at that distributed edge. And Qualcomm really thinks it can build chips. I mean, with gateway devices, you know, are basically smartphone chips. Intel has a line of products there, but they really haven't invested in it in a while. So I'm sitting here thinking Qualcomm's got a lot of opportunity there. So
I think Intel is in the middle of a shift. I mean, clearly they're moving forward with their high-end desktop laptop processor, server chips, and so on. But they're talking more about ARM than ever before. It's a multi-year transition to kind of attack that market. So right now, Qualcomm has a big lead, but we'll have to see what happens in the next couple of years.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's that's the story of our lives.
That's the repeating broken record of Intel chasing somebody else's good technology, in a sense.
Yikes. All right. Speaking of ARM, hey, do y'all remember that, like, last year, NVIDIA was like, yeah, we're going to spend $40 billion to take over ARM. And ARM was like, yeah, we like this deal. And regulators around the world were like, what? Big record scratch. Well, the UK has now ordered a further inquiry into the ARM-NVIDIA tie-up, thinking that, oh my gosh, it might be anti-competitive, especially since ARM is like, I was going to say an arms dealer to the entire chip industry. Gosh, ARM's clients, ARM designs processors, and companies like Qualcomm, Amazon, Google, NXP, just Apple. Everybody who's anybody, they take the ARM license and designs, and then they actually design their chips around that core architecture, and then they give it over to a fab, and a fab manufactures it. But the point here is, if NVIDIA takes it over, NVIDIA is kind of a competitor, potentially, to someone like Qualcomm, for example.
To all the ARM licensees.
Yeah. Well, not to all, but it could be. I mean, with AI and NVIDIA expanding its scope so much, which makes sense because everything, especially if you think about the metaverse and like putting graphics processing, I know. But if we accept that computing is going to become more visual in more places, then we do have to think about, well, maybe Qualcomm does want to invest in graphics. And if ARM and NVIDIA are tied up, that could be a problem for them. So I don't see how this deal is going to happen, but, you know.
I'm kind of with you on that. And in this story, NVIDIA's comment was the merger would boost competition and innovation.
Okay, no. We're not even saying that. We're just, like, that's like both sidism. Of course they're going to say that. Anyway, sorry. I'm like,
Yes, this is a very common statement in these types of situations. But in this one, more than ever, that is just so not true, in my opinion.
Okay, me too. I agree. Okay, let's talk about privacy and one of those ARM licensees, Apple.
Apple, yes. Apple, which actually is, at least they tout the most privacy amongst their products. We can argue and debate that if we'd like, but I tend to believe it's true. They have a patent that allows users, in theory, I mean, this is not a product yet, that allows users to have their screens, their, say, an iPhone screen, blurred out so that other people cannot see it. The only person who could see it is somebody who is wearing special glasses. Maybe the glasses are Bluetooth tied to the phone. They're Apple AR, VR glasses. Who knows? There's been lots of discussion of them getting in on this wearable face viewing thing. I don't want to say metaverse, but I guess I will. The metaverse. So it's kind of interesting. I don't know that there's a big need for that. I mean, you could buy privacy screens now that do this.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to wear glasses just to do this. But if you think about, take it outside of the context of your phone, but bring it into like a corporate environment, right? So if you had admin privileges for certain data, you could see, you know, whatever, right? Or as a journalist, if I'm walking into a corporation, you could even think about like, you know, opaque windows or something like that, you know, to hide projects happening, right? So especially if you think about, like, sometimes it's interesting to walk through a company office and just see if they have the digital tablets outside their conference rooms. You can see who's meeting, right?
True.
So I'm just trying to think, you know, there may be a use case for, I mean, in the most dystopian view, right? If you've got access to my bank account and you know who I am, maybe I get to see only things that apply to my bank account. Ah!
Yeah, no, there's definite use cases there that are very specific task-oriented things. To have to wear glasses or some device to see them, it's not something I want to do. I'm not saying I represent the market, but...
Yeah. It's only the first stage, Kevin.
This is true.
All right. So, again, this is a patent. This is just thinking. This is not real. But another Apple story that is real. Sam Jadala, who was the head of home services that included HomeKit stuff, he has left Apple. He joined Apple in February of 2019 after he created a smart lock brand called Otto. Otto was really cool. It was like a $700 smart lock. So it didn't go very far. But he's a smart dude. I talked to him back at Otto. Obviously, when you're at Apple, you never talk to the press.
No.
So, haven't talked to him for a while, but I can't wait to see what he does next. Apple did just bring in someone fairly recently on the audio side, but I mean, I feel a little disappointed about what Apple's done with HomeKit and home automation. And I mean, it is working with Matter, so we'll see, but I don't know. I'm just kind of like, eh.
Well, disappointed, what are you doing, disappointed how? I'm just curious. I'm not disagreeing necessarily.
I felt like Apple was going to be the company that brought us good user interfaces and really brought us closer to more intuition in the smart home. But in fact, it's actually been Amazon that's kind of led the way there. And even Google, like Google sticking solely on its devices. Google's actually pushing with local onboard processing for data. And then you look at Amazon and what they're doing. They've done a lot of interesting work around things like hunches. And I really thought a lot of that would come from Apple, but it really hasn't.
Well, in general, I would agree. But like the hunches is a great feature with Amazon. And we do get suggestions in the home app as soon as you add a device. I mean, it's...
Yeah, they haven't totally failed. I just feel like...
Yeah, and all their stuff is local. So, I mean, it's... You know, they've been local before everybody else to a large extent. I would agree that it's been a slow progression. I mean, HomeKit was here first, and then eventually got Madam A and Google and so on. And I feel like in many ways, Apple has been surpassed. But are they features that are must-haves that Apple says we need to add it right now? I don't think they do. I'm not saying I agree with that, but they tend to see what other people do in a market, see what works, and then improve upon it. And I think that's kind of why they're considered behind right now.
And it could be that once Matter comes out, we've got a baseline interoperability, we'll see Apple develop features on top of that that really push it over the top. I mean, yeah. It's possible. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah. All right. Amazon. Speaking of Amazon, they have announced three-way smart switches, single-pole dimmers, three-way dimmers, and just plain old light switches for the low, low prices of between $18 and $21. And yes, these all require neutral wire. But if you are in the market for a connected light switch, the reason why you'd want these is because you've got a bunch of light bulbs, so you don't want to replace all your bulbs, or... I mean, really, that's why you would want them. You want to add voice control to your existing light switches, but you don't want to do smart bulbs because then people get confused. And when you turn them off, they stay out. It's just a lot.
The other reason you may want them is because you use Amazon as your smart home platform of choice. And, you know, if you need a basic, and these are actually Amazon basics, they're branded that way, smart switches, they use 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, no 5 gigahertz. I kind of get that at this price. I'm surprised that they actually came out with these in a way, but then again, they often come out with their own.
Yeah. I mean, look at that $60 thermostat. They're just like, we're just going to put out all this cheap gear so you can have basically they want to make it super cheap for you to smartify your home and then control it with Alexa.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. And if you put these in, I mean, presumably if one day they become Matter compliant, you could control them with other devices, but you know, that's not their, they don't care.
They want to be the Wyze of the smart home world. Low, low
exactly.
prices.
Poor Wyze, man.
I know.
Got to come up with something. Amazon also now has turned on a feature in your Echo devices. So your latest Echo and Echo Dot speakers have something called ultrasonic sensors. And all this does is when you walk into a room, you'll disrupt the ultrasonic. It'll put out a high-pitched beeping. It's not... I turned mine on. My dog does not seem to care.
I was wondering about that.
She is 10 and a half. So, you know, I don't know how great her hearing is, but she can hear the doorbell and the crunch of the UPS truck hitting the gravel of our driveway, you know, a tenth of a mile away. Anyway, so you turn that on and you can now do routines based on occupancy. And this is pretty cool. I turned it on. It is under motion detection in the Madam A app settings. You have to do it for each Echo device. So you're not going to turn all of your Echo devices on at once. So maybe if you only want this in one room, that's how you could do this. And yeah, I mean, it's a pretty cool thing. I would use it to like turn lights on. I have it turning my lights on in my bedroom and it works just fine for that. You come into the bedroom and the lights turn on. But I will say I didn't set it to turn off just because, you know, I read a lot in bed and I was like, ooh, is it like motion? Is it going to turn off? But I realized I should have done that because then I could tell you it was like that. So next week you can ask me.
I have to check and see if my Google Nest display supports this because I have one of the original ones. And I know that Google added ultrasound sensing to a bunch of its devices.
It's not the original one doesn't have it. It's the first generation Nest Hub, as opposed to, remember they were like, they used to be called something else, Google Smart Displays, maybe?
That could be. I'll have to check in my settings because it would be nice to have the lights go on when we walk in the bedroom where I have one of those.
Google doesn't use it like that. Google on it, they use it actually to figure out how close you are to the screen and adapt the information on the screen to the, it's bigger if you're farther away.
Oh, so you can't actually set up a routine or anything?
I don't think so. I haven't looked recently, but so I can look, or, you know, someone, if you work at Google, let us know. Can you do that now? Are you trying to do it? Let us know if you do it. Okay. Let's talk about dupes.
Yes. Can I just say, I looked at these devices that we're about to talk about and said, oh, Nanoleaf has relaunched their old products, but no. Yeelight has actually introduced its new product, smart LED light panels.
Yes. So Yeelight is, they're basically the Nanoleaf triangles. I mean, that is what they are. But they are available for, well, I think it's $130 normally, but they've got a Black Friday code that you can use for $97.99. These work with Google Home, Amazon, Xiaomi. They sync with the Chroma Razer RGB keyboards and games. Yeah.
Yeah.
These,
I don't know what else to say because I see Nanoleafs.
Yeah. So, oh, that pricing I gave you, the 30% off, is only before November 30th. And they'll ship on December 1. I mean, you know what? At that price, I'm tempted to order them for my nephew and my niece. I'll be honest.
Yeah. I mean, Nanoleaf products in general make a really nice gift, but they're not a cheap gift by any means, either for you or for your, you know, your friends or your family. You can get something that's comparable for less. Yeah, why not?
And Yeelight is owned by Xiaomi. So that is the big Chinese smart home device manufacturer platform. So their stuff is proven. Do you worry about privacy policies and your data going to China? I mean, maybe if you bought this, you'd stick it on your guest network and, I don't know, they're connected lights, y'all.
Exactly. I mean, somebody turn their lights on, somebody turn their lights off. I mean, yes, you can learn about people's habits and routines and patterns and all that, but, you know, it's not like they're listening and sending voice snippets of what you say near the lights, so.
And the Yeelight stuff, some of their stuff does work with Home Assistant. I don't know if these will.
If they don't yet, I'm sure they will soon.
Yeah, so there you go. Okay, so if you are interested in dupes for Nanoleaf, this seems like a good option. And, you know, get thee to a website. We also have another really cool option as a potential gift mostly for you, probably. If you're listening to this show, this is a gift for you. And you would have to be a HomeKit user. But Kevin found this particular app that has been around for a while. And holy cow, it sounds awesome. Tell us about it.
Yeah, and I kind of feel bad that I hadn't heard of it before. As I said at the beginning of the show, this is in its fifth version now, fifth major release now. It's been out for at least 3 years from what I can see. It's called Controller for HomeKit. It is for Mac, Apple Watch, iOS, iPad. So if you don't use HomeKit, you don't use Apple devices, Stacey, I guess you can just tune out now.
Someone has to try all the other platforms, Kevin.
Yeah, she got the short straw. So, but even if you don't, I mean, this is actually kind of interesting because it tells you what a good smart home application could be. And I call this the smart home app for power users. So I say that because Apple's home app, it's good. I'm not complaining about it. It's what I've used. And anybody using HomeKit probably uses it too. But as I said to Stacey just before the show, Apple kind of hides features and data just to have everything simple and usable at its lowest common denominator. It doesn't want to overwhelm people with too many options, too much data, too many choices. And for a power user, I think that's a bad thing. So what Controller for HomeKit does, which is available in the iOS App Store, it builds upon Apple's Home app. It basically has all the same features, but it also adds a lot of additional features. I could probably spend an hour talking about you doing that, but Stacey will kill me, so I won't do that. So I'm going to give you some very quick bullet-level highlights and just discuss my experience briefly. So you can use this app for free. You can then continue to use it for free as long as you want. But if you want these advanced features I'm going to talk about, they are part of the Pro app, which is $2.99 a month or $14.99 a year or $29.99 for a lifetime subscription. I want to say that the $14.99 yearly subscription does offer you a free 7-week trial. And that's what I used. I'm actually at my 7th day, so I've got to decide what I'm going to do. Here's what it adds over the Apple Home app. So smart folders is one of them, where you can group your devices, rooms, whatever you want into smart folders. I like this because in the Home app, I have rooms, but it's not, they're all in a drop-down box. I have to see every single room name just to switch from one room to another. I don't want to do that. Smart folders makes it easier to organize things. You get enhanced Apple Watch features where you can create custom screens for your Apple Watch for this app. I set one up for a nighttime screen, so that way only devices I really care about at nighttime are showing there. And that just, again, makes it easier and faster to get to what I need. HomeKit backup and restore functionality, which Apple actually has. You can back up everything to iCloud. This does the same thing, backs everything up to iCloud, but you can also have local backups to restore right on your iOS devices, which is nice.
Ooh, that is nice.
It is handy. HomeKit QR code storage. I am always, 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 always looking for the HomeKit QR code when I have some kind of device issue or a Wi-Fi issue and I need to re-add a device or whatever.
This is actually a problem I have with, I mean, not just HomeKit devices. I actually have created a folder and I have to physically cut out the QR codes and like write what they are. And it's stupid. And then if I want to send the box with somebody, like if I want to sell my gadget, then I'm like, now I got to
find the code. This is nice because you can literally use the camera in the app to scan the QR codes and it will store them for you. Basically, you have access to them all. But even better, if you wanted to print them out, which I think is a good idea, at least whenever you maybe have to reset certain things up, you can print these out. And I say that because storing the HomeKit QR codes is one thing, but to scan a device and re-add it, you almost need, you know, two iPhones, one to show the QR code and one to scan the QR code. If you have a printed copy, you can do it by yourself. So that's handy. They have something called workflows that I didn't get enough value out of personally. It's like a manual automation routines for frequent tasks where you can, you know, click a button to have something happen, such as printing out all the battery statuses of your battery powered devices and whatnot. I guess it's kind of like Tasker in Android. These are one-off things, or you can have whole workflows where a bunch of things take off, but they're manual-based things. I just didn't see a need from the way I use HomeKit. A complete log of all your HomeKit activity comes with the pro version as well. So every single thing that HomeKit does, touches, or changes, it's just all there. And that can be super handy if you need to troubleshoot something in the case of some issue of some kind. And in relation to that, they also have maintenance information on your devices in the app. So it's constantly scanning for what devices do have a low battery, what devices are disconnected right now, what rooms in HomeKit have you set up that aren't doing anything anymore? And I actually had one of these and it found it for me. And of course, I didn't realize it because I set it up ages ago and I guess I moved the devices out of it and it's just taking up space. So there's all kinds of maintenance information at the very detailed level for you. And lastly, you get custom app icons and the ability to hide device attributes you don't want to see, which could be handy because things can be overwhelming. What I really liked, and this kind of goes in conjunction with the hiding device attributes you don't want to see, Controller for HomeKit gives you more than just the Apple Surface details of every device. It also includes the vendor-specific data. So I can find out, like I found out thread information from some of the Eve thread devices that the app has, that Home has, but doesn't tell you about. All kinds of attributes, current state, light levels of every sensor, and so on. So you can actually use that data if you want. If you don't want to, that's fine. But you could use that for automations, which is really cool. And speaking of the automations, they have a very good automation creation setup, which is very similar to HomeKit, but it adds conditions as well. So if you want an automation to kick off only when somebody is home, it will check that condition and it won't run the automation if nobody is home. So there's just a lot more flexibility and power here. So is it worth it for you? I think that's a personal choice question that you need to answer. You can probably do it with the free trial of the Pro app, or even just get some benefit from just using the free version of the app just to see what's what.
Yeah, sounds like it's worth it for you. Are you really still on the fence? I mean, $30 is nothing.
I think $30 is probably worth it for me just based on the value I got out of it. And a lot of it has to do with the Apple Watch customization as well. Again, it's going to depend on what functions people want.
Well, yes. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Kevin. And I think that's sufficient for this segment of the show this week. Now it's time for the IoT Podcast Hotline, which is brought to you by Very. Very is a fully distributed IoT engineering firm that partners with its clients to build systems for smart manufacturing, smart energy, consumer electronics, and connected wellness. You can discover what Very's multidisciplinary teams can do for you at www.verypossible.com/services. Okay. Hey, remember, every month we give away a prize here at the IoT Podcast Hotline. This is where we answer your questions and we enter you into this drawing. This month's prize is the NanoLeaf Lines. This is a review unit, so it has been opened, but they all work. It's good. And they're fancy, like truly fancy.
They're very nice.
Yeah, Kevin's jealous. He's been calling the hotline every day.
I have the review unit boxed up and ready to send to this month's winner, and I kind of don't want to. It's
like, if you don't get it, it's Kevin's fault.
It'll be my fault.
Anyway, you can enter to win by calling us and asking us a question or just saying, hey, I'd like to win. 512-623-7424. And you know what? I'd do it because right now your chances are looking good. But this week, we have a call from Michael. Let's hear it.
My question this week is pretty simple. I have a HomeKit set up in my home, so this is probably a question for Kevin. Sorry, Stacy. My question is simple. I have several closets in my house that I want to set up with light strips that turn on when I open the door. My question is, because I've looked, is what would you recommend for a reasonable setup for this, i.e. what model and make of light strips, HomeKit-enabled light strips, could I look at, and what sort of sensor would you recommend to trigger it? Love the show. Keep up the great work. Thank you.
Oh, Michael, this is actually a use case I have set up in my house, so I can help you. You don't have to apologize to me. My first thought was, hey, go with Philips Hue. It's HomeKit compatible. They've got light strips. They have a dedicated motion sensor that works with their gear. So you don't have to worry about like future-proofing kind of issues, it is expensive. I mean, depending on how many light strips you need, the motion sensor and all that, I think I spent $320 for like four bulbs and one motion sensor. So it's a lot, but it was worth it for the closet that I was working in. But Kevin, who is like, no need to be that fancy, has other ideas.
No. I can save you a little money. You have lots of choices, to be honest, and to be fair. From a HomeKit standpoint, we found light strips from Nanoleaf, Lifex, Philips Hue, Eve, Meros, and others. So you've got choices there from a HomeKit light strip standpoint. The bigger challenge is the sensor. And to be honest, you could easily get an Eve door and window sensor is probably what I would do. I wouldn't do a motion sensor in the closet. I actually have an Eve door and window sensor on my closet door to turn on other lights, regular, just smart lights, not HomeKit lights. So I know this works. They use Bluetooth and they support Thread, so you're kind of future-proof there. And you could pair them with the Eve light strip, which is 6.6 feet. It costs you about $80 for that light strip, which compared to the Philips Hue is probably less expensive. But Nanoleaf Essentials light strips are like normally $50. They're currently on sale for $40. It's an 80-inch light strip, so not much difference there. It also supports Thread, so they should work together, that light strip and your Eve door window sensor. Again, any HomeKit door window sensor would work. I think it's probably the best way to go in terms of when to turn those lights on and off from a trigger event. So you definitely have options there.
Yeah. So good luck. Feel free to let us know what you chose. And yeah, and I think it's a great use case. I put them in my closet. I also put them in my laundry room way back in the day. My current laundry room doesn't have this issue, but like I was going in and my lights were always like, they were on the wrong side. They weren't where I wanted them to be. And so it was hard to maneuver to turn the light switch on, basically. But with that, I just walked in with like my arms full of laundry and the lights popped on and then I could, you know, do what I need to do. And then when I left, it had a timer and it would just go off after a certain time. I've put it in bathrooms, closets. I mean, it's just really handy.
Yeah, we've lived here for 5 years now and we still walk into the closet by turning the light on, which is outside of the closet. And then when we leave, we shut the door of the closet and we forget to turn the light off. So that's why I have the door window sensor in the closet and the lights going on, so on and so forth. So it's definitely handy because our lights would run for hours and we wouldn't even know it.
Although with LED lights, it's not the end of the world.
It's not the end of the world by any means, but still it's the way a smart home should work, darn it.
Exactly. All right. So remember, if you would like to be entered to win the Nanoleaf lines for the month of November, you just have to call us at November 30th before midnight ET, and you will be entered to win. That number to call is 512-623-7424. And that concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, who is Jen Kaltritter, who is from Mozilla, talking about the brand new Privacy Not Included report of basically how much data do all these smart home devices and wearables take, and are they secure? It's a really fun interview. Y'all are going to love it. We talk about local storage, but first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Twilio. Hey, everybody. We are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Twilio. And many of you might know Twilio as a provider of APIs for SMS, voice, and other customer communication channels. But Twilio also has IoT offerings. So I have with me here Elle Grossenbacher, who is a principal product marketing manager for Twilio IoT. How's it going, Elle?
I'm doing great, Stacey. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, so Twilio has this IoT SIM as one of its offerings, and it's the Super SIM. And everyone claims these days that they have global coverage with a single IoT SIM. So do you. So how exactly is Twilio different?
Yeah, so here at Twilio, we actually believe that we are the only vendor that can truly deliver on that global SIM promise. Now, let me explain why we feel that way. Many IoT connectivity companies leverage EUICC or eSIM technology to offer multiple carriers on a single SIM. We do that through an approach known as multi-IMSI. So you can think of multi-IMSI as several global roaming identities on a single SIM. That's different from having several carrier SIM profiles on a SIM. With multi-IMSI, it's still just one profile, but you get access to hundreds of networks through that one profile. And you get multiple top-tier carriers in a single country. So for example, with Twilio IoT in the United States, you get T-Mobile and AT&T and soon Verizon. Or in the United Kingdom, you get Vodafone, EE, and Three, among others. So what does this mean for our customers? They can expand into any country with a single SIM. We've already had really positive feedback from customers around fast time to market, scalability, and streamlined manufacturing, which is thanks to a single SKU that would not be possible without a truly global single SIM. What's more, our customers get just one bill and only have to go through a single mobile core network, which we developed ourselves.
Very cool. So what can customers do if they want to give the Twilio Super SIM a try?
Well, they're in luck. We offer a free trial. We encourage anyone who wants to try Super SIM to go to twil.io/freesim to have a look. That's twil.io, as in Twilio, /freesim. There you will find tips and pointers to more product information about Super SIM if you want to do a little more research on your own before you give it a try.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham. And today's guest is Jen Kaltrider, who is the lead on the Privacy Not Included package from Mozilla. Hi, Jen. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. Okay. Every year for the last 5 years, or this is the fifth year, Mozilla puts out a package y'all are probably all familiar with it because we talk about it on the show every year that talks about different products and how they do or do not violate your privacy. And this year, I think it's the biggest one yet. Is it the biggest one yet, Jen?
It is. This year, we've reviewed 151 products across six categories to see how they do on privacy and security.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not going to lie, y'all. There are tons of things on here that I actually currently have in my house, including the Fi dog collar and all of the smart speakers out there. So, yay us. But Jen, let's first talk about why do y'all do this report?
Well, we started back in 2017 at Mozilla, kind of looking around at privacy and the exploding kind of Internet of Things connected devices space, and recognized that, you know, while there are plenty of people doing reviews out there, Consumer Reports and Tom's Guide and CNET and on and on and on, they weren't really looking at the privacy and security of products in their reviews. They were looking at features and cost and reliability. And we saw a need for that. And we also kind of recognized that coming up with the criteria that you rate products on privacy security is a little challenging. And so we kind of dug into that and we're like, well, let's try something. Instead of trying to get it perfect, let's try something and see what works. And so we just kind of asked the questions that we would want consumers to ask of, you know, when you're buying a connected product, what does it know about you? How can it use what it knows about you? Can you control what it knows about you? Can it snoop on you? What's the worst thing that could happen if something goes wrong? And we kind of approached the research initially with those questions in mind. And then along over the years since 2017, we've kind of refined those based on feedback from people and the evolving kind of nature of our technology, because the ultimate goal is to give people just enough information. We don't want to overwhelm them, but just enough information to make some smart decisions when they're shopping for, you know, a fitness tracker. There's a lot of options out there. They're collecting a lot of sensitive data, which company is going to handle that data the best, and then go out and buy based on that and try and kind of push companies to do better with your dollars. That was our goal back in 2017, and it's our goal today too.
Excellent. And I appreciate that goal. And I do like the way y'all talk about this. So if something is, y'all have a not creepy versus really creepy kind of scale, which I appreciate. So let's talk about what it is that makes something not creepy, because we focus on the smart home here. So there are only about 8 or 9 products that aren't creepy, including Eufy video doorbells, Roombas, the Withings thermo and body scale, the Wyze camera, the Sonos, the Apple HomePod mini all seem to be not creepy.
Yeah. We love our creepometer because it lets people tell us how creepy or not creepy they think a product is based on A, how they feel, and B, what we tell them about it. And it's really fascinating to see what people find creepy and not creepy. And for me, what makes something creepy is how much data it collects on me. You know, is it collecting as much as it possibly can, or is it collecting the bare minimum to function? And we look at that. And then, you know, how is it using that data? You know, some of the companies just come right out in their privacy policies and say, hey, we're going to sell your data to third parties. We're going to buy data from data brokers and combine it with the data we collect on you to build a bigger profile so we could try and sell you more stuff. The scariest privacy policy I read this year came right out and said, if you give us your phone number, we'll text you and call you and try and market you stuff, even if you're on a do not call list. And I was like, dang, man. Like,
that's who does that?
NordicTrack. NordicTrack had earned this year's award for the creepiest privacy policy that I read. So that makes stuff creepy. And then, you know, and then there's the security side of things. And one of the things that is astounding to me is we look at, you know, does it use the product to use encryption? Does it require a strong password? Does it have a way to manage security vulnerabilities and all that just to meet our minimum security standards? And this is stuff that most consumers probably don't think about, but we think it's important to just do the bare minimum to be on the market. But the other thing that we look at when we're reviewing our products is the company's known track record of protecting users' data and security. And this year, the thing that surprised me was how just about every company, every major company, at least the smaller ones, don't have as many reported security lapses or data leaks, but almost all of the big companies have had issues. And, you know, obviously, Facebook is pretty well known with their, you know, security lapses and data leaks and things like that. But every company from Apple on down, even the good ones, Apple has had a problem. Eufy, that I actually own the Eufy security cameras because I like that they had the local storage. And, you know, they had a little security bug. It didn't affect the huge number of people, but it gave 719 people or something like that control over other people's cameras, which is kind of your worst nightmare when you're buying a security camera. And so that looking at a company's known track record and kind of understanding the effort that they put into protecting the privacy and security of their consumers, how quickly they respond when something's found that there's a bug or a security vulnerability or a leak. Looking at that is really telling for us. And I was just kind of surprised at how every company, even the good ones, have had these issues. The good ones fix them faster and are more transparent about it. And the bad ones, like Facebook, tend to not be as transparent about things. So that, to me, is what makes something creepy.
That's fair. And I would say that's in line with what we tell our audience. I always recommend to people, before you buy any connected product, look, Google it, see how they handle the inevitable security breaches, because security breaches are going to happen pretty much all the time. It's just an ongoing fight, right? So how do they handle it? Do they patch quickly? Do they tell people? And then we also tell people to look for companies that have bug bounties that seem to be proactive about accepting vulnerability research. So I like that. You mentioned something pretty important, which is you look for local storage. Most of our audience does too. And that's why we've recommended like the Wyze cameras, those sorts of things. But there's also a big shift to on-device processing, even from bigger companies like Google with their version 2 of the Nest Hub display. That particular product takes a lot of very sensitive data. Basically, for me, it's like snoring, who's in your bed, all of that kind of information. And analyzes it on device and then sends back data or input to you. Amazon's starting to make the same effort with some of their devices with audio processing. I don't know if that makes it less creepy, equally creepy. How do we feel about on device processing of data?
Personally, it seems to make a lot of sense, right? Like the less that you send out into the world, the less that's out there that people could access and learn about you. So doing things locally, keeping things locally seems to make a lot of sense. And it's good to see companies doing more of it. Apple's doing it with their processing Siri requests locally. iRoomba's doing it with, you know, keeping the maps stored locally. Like you said, you know, Google is doing it. Amazon is starting to do that, like with their Halo device, which is kind of creepy, but it's good that they're processing things more locally. So yeah, I would say what you and your listeners are doing is perfect. You know, keep things as local as possible. The less that's out into the world, the better. And if you're like me and live somewhere where you have, you know, kind of data limits, it's also less data that's having to go down the inner tubes and be shared in the world. So that's another good thing.
Agree. It's also more energy efficient. Every time you move data around, you are burning up electrons. All right. So as part of the evaluation, y'all look at a couple things. Y'all look at privacy policies. Y'all look at the type of data that can be collected. You mentioned the security stuff. You look at the types of sensors it has, correct? Where are we heading right now, do you think? Do you think we're getting creepier or less privacy conscious, maybe more security conscious?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question of where we're heading. And I think since 2017, when we started this, you know, back then, fewer companies met our minimum security standards, meaning they, you know, did things like have bug bounties and require encryption and strong passwords and things like that. Now we see a lot of companies, almost all of them do meet our minimum security standards. What we're seeing, though, is so much more data is now able to be collected with fitness trackers and security cams and robot vacuums that have HD cameras and microphones that you can zoom around your home. Like, there's just so much data being collected out there. And companies are pushing as much as possible, from what I can tell, reading privacy policies, of how much data they can collect and how they can use this data. And that, to me, seems to be the creepy angle. You know, the home exercise equipment, for example, I think that was probably the worst category, because almost all of the products that we reviewed earned our privacy not included ding, because they do tend to collect a fair amount of information on their users, you know, their exercise equipment. So they're asking for things like weight, and there's cameras and microphones. But then they're like, data, we'll share the data with third parties, you know, we'll combine the data with data brokers. And that's where it starts to get really creepy to me, is these building these profiles on you to sell you more stuff. And then you start to be like, well, okay, well, how securely is NordicTrack keeping this data? You know, it's like, if Google and Apple are having data leaks and things, like, is NordicTrack going to be good at keeping all this stuff really safe? I don't know. Is, you know, SoulCycle going to be great at it? Is Peloton? And so for me, it's the huge amounts of data that we collect that are able to be collected right now, and that we give up freely because we want to get in better shape, or we want to, you know if our neighbor's at the door. Companies are really kind of pushing how they can use this data and share this data. And the data broker piece, we're buying more data to build profiles on you. It just starts to feel like this is getting out of control.
I agree. And in your opinion, what are the worst cases here?
You know, there's a lot of worse things that could happen. And I think about this a lot, because in the guide, I actually, you know, write a little blurb that kind of says what's the worst thing that could happen. And sometimes I have fun with it. Sometimes it's based on real life things. But, you know, if you think about all the data that's being collected right now, you know, and people keep waiting for the worst thing to happen, and they aren't feeling it right now. And that's true. You know, we both have security cameras and smart speakers and you know, things in our home that could invade our privacy, but we don't. We take some measures, but we still have them because they're convenient and they're fun. And I think that the thing that worries me, and the thing that I feel like we're heading towards, is we're getting to that place where, maybe not you and I, because we're older. No, not calling you old or anything, but we're older than kids that are growing up right now, who are having data collected on them almost from birth. And this data is being used to build these profiles on them, that to know a lot about them. And as we're, you know, I read an article last week about how Amazon wants you to stop talking to Alexa as much. They want Alexa to start predicting what you're going to want. And so, you know, we've all been told, oh, smart speakers are safe because you have to say the wake word, you know, and they aren't listening to you all the time. But if Amazon wants to go to a future where it knows your baby's crying, or it knows that you're singing a certain song, I'm just making that up, like, and then it can predict what you want next, that's starting to get into a different level of information that we're giving big companies. And so you're just, you know, right now, okay, so they know I like pepperoni pizza and Taylor Swift. Okay, what's the harm in that? But when you're kind of like a young person and you've had all this data collected on you all your life, and they start to be able to predict your emotions, and they start to be able to like use this to kind of manipulate you in ways that you might not even be aware of, which we're getting a little bit now, but I think it's only going to grow in the future. Like, that's, to me, is where it gets creepy. And we're not at a tipping point yet where people are going to say, okay, enough is enough. This is harmful. That's coming. And that feels like it might be coming in the next 5 years, where people just say, you know too much about me, And now it's creepy that you're manipulating my emotions or trying to use my emotions to get me not just to buy stuff, but to take actions that may or may not be morally okay. I think that for me is the worst case scenario that can happen. Aside from the, oh, somebody hacked your camera and can look at you while you're sleeping. That, of course, is creepy.
I would agree with you. I think what's really challenging for anyone in this space is it's really easy to say, hey, I want my home or my computers to help offload certain mental tasks, right? Or to help me to be intuitive, right? Like any good personal assistant, they know a lot about you, right? And then you want them to act on your behalf. But right now, most people don't realize that a lot of the times they're acting on the company's behalf. The company is happy right now to have you be, you know, using it and content and whatnot, but it could easily get weird. Like Amazon right now, my Madam A device is suggesting good Christmas presents for me to buy people. And I'm like, nope, shut it down. So it's kind of like where personalized surveillance stops being for my benefit and starts implementing dark patterns for the company's benefit. The obvious question is, based on this, you put out the list, we're going to link to it in the show notes. What advice do you have for consumers who, you know, the people who listen to our show, we like gadgets. We would also value our privacy and security. So what recommendations do you have for us?
Well, I love gadgets too. The things that I do when before I buy a gadget or buy a gadget from someone else are, I look at the company's known track record and determine, is this a good company? I got a Garmin fitness tracker because I trusted Garmin more than I did Fitbit or some of the other fitness tracker makers. So that's a big thing. And it's great that you already recommend that. I don't imagine people are going to go out and spend a lot of time reading privacy policies, but you don't actually have to read them all if you don't want. You can just go to the privacy policy and search for words like sell, control F. Does it say it sells my data? Oh, if it does, I wouldn't probably buy a product from that company. Data brokers, data resellers is another word to search for in a privacy policy. If they say they buy or sell data with those, I probably wouldn't get a product from them. And then it's, you know, if you're buying for someone else, it's, you know, it's all about risk assessment. We do these risk assessments every day for ourselves. Talk to your mom, talk to your nephew and niece, or, you know, your best friend about how cool are you with having a smart speaker or a smart home display or a flying camera drone or a robot vacuum with an HD camera that you can zoom around your house. Like, are you comfortable with that? You know, just having conversations with people about what they feel comfortable with. That's what I did with my mom when I got her a robot vacuum. That goes a long way. And even just those conversations, because I'm going to guess that you and I and the people that listen to your show probably think about this a lot more than most of the people out there. You know, having those conversations are just great because it gets people thinking that maybe aren't usually thinking about these questions.
And I'll add to this, you kind of alluded to this, but I always recommend having a conversation when you bring a connected device in your home. And if you share your home with other people, I think it's really important to talk to them about like, hey, this thing actually has a microphone. It's always on. This particular device has an accelerometer, or, you know, I brought a smart scale in and my husband was like, nope, not putting any of, you know, I don't want any of thing to do with that. But I told him what it did, what it collected. And I think that's really important from a consent perspective to get the consent of everyone in your home and explain what they're giving up.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
Okay. And because a lot of the people who make these products listen to this show, I would love to hear from you. Man, what would you like to see from them?
Well, my first request of any company is make your privacy policy easy to find, because good Lord, there are just way too many companies out there that hide their privacy policies in just crazy places. They should be easy to find. If I click on a privacy policy link on your website and it takes me to a privacy policy that is only for your website, but not for the devices you sell, that's not a good look. If I go to your app page and click on a privacy policy link and it doesn't link me to the privacy policy for the app, it links me to a privacy policy for your website, that's not a good look. Make your privacy content user-friendly is my first request. You know, and some companies do a good job at this. Google does a good job. Apple does a good job. And then some companies, dear Lord, I just poked my eyeball out trying to find their privacy policies and understand why they hid them so much. And then I think transparency and honesty go a long, long way towards trust. And I have spent the past couple of months trying to read every document that Amazon has put out about their privacy and security of their 8 million connected devices. And man, oh man, they are just, you know, it's just really hard to get clarity after, you know, okay, you read this privacy policy document, and then it links you to this FAQ document, and then it sends you to a advertising disclosure document. And by the time you've read all of those, you're like, I have no idea what Amazon is actually doing. I have more questions than I have answers. It shouldn't be like that. And then secure your stuff. Keep your stuff as secure as you can. And you know, everything, as you well know, anything that's on the internet is just inherently going to be insecure. And something's going to happen at some point. If something happens, if somebody reports a bug, fix it. Fix it immediately. Communicate with your people, your consumers that there was a bug. Here's how to fix it. Just be really open and honest and transparent. It really boils down to what's creepy and what's not creepy when you look at how companies handle that.
I know I said I had the last question, but do you think a company can change from being creepy to not creepy?
Yeah, I think iRobot, a few years back, I believe it was 2017, there was some reporting that they were collecting mapping data and maybe using that data in potentially questionable ways. You know, that's not something that you necessarily want to be shared far and wide, is a map of your home. And since then, I think iRobot has done a great job of addressing the concerns, really being good about what data they collect, being clear with consumers about how they use that data, giving consumers the option to keep mapping data locally only on their devices and not even sharing that with the company. And so I think that that's an instance where, you know, whether or not iRobot was actually doing something terrible back in 2017, I can't confirm, but since they got called out, they've made some, I would say, some really good strides to make it clear to consumers what data is being collected, how that data is being used, and how consumers can control that data. And I think that's exactly what you want to see as a consumer, is if there's a question, the company addresses it head on, is very clear about how they're managing it, and is taking the consumer's concerns into consideration.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for both doing the report and coming on the show to talk to us this week.
Thank you for having me.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyoniot.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.